Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm John Neff.
And I'm Damon Lavrance.
And I have to welcome Damon to the group. Damon is the newest hire for Autoblog, and he joined the team about 2 weeks ago, maybe?
About that now, yeah.
About that? So how do you like it so far?
I'm loving it. It's a lot of hours, but it's a labor of love, so.
I think for most of us, it's hours we were spending in front of the computer anyway. So if we can get paid a little bit to do it, then we're happy
hey,
to.
We're all the happier for it, no
yeah.
doubt.
So on today's episode of the Autoblog Podcast, we're going to attempt to go over all the earning reports from GM, Daimler Chrysler, Ford for the second quarter.
That is a massive undertaking.
Yeah, it's massive, and I'm fairly certain we're going to fail, but we're going to give it a go anyway. See how we do. After that, we're going to talk about the Tesla Roadster, which I think Autoblog and Autoblog Green, obviously, we were all really into that. I don't know how much of the rest of the automotive world was into it, but I think we definitely saw it as almost a monumental occasion.
Well, we're on the cutting edge. They're on the cutting edge. So that's just, yeah.
Well,
we're
and
trying to safen our own.
We took the expense to send them out there, so we had to be into it, really, to make it worth our while. And then after the Tesla Roadster, we're going to talk about the Mazda Speed 3 because pricing was announced for it this past week. And I think we're also really into this vehicle. So we're going to talk about it and its impact in the market, its competition. So before we begin, I want to give Volvo, who are sponsors of the Autoblog Podcast, a chance to say a few words.
The Volvo XC90 has won over 50 international automotive awards, including the 2005 Best Pick from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com Top 10 Award for Best Resale Value. Visit www.volvocars.us for more information.
Okay, and we're back, and we are going to start off the show today with kind of an overview of the second quarter earnings from the big three or the big two plus Daimler Chrysler, however you want to refer to it. And I think, you know, before the show, I tried to sum it up to you, Damon, by saying basically GM did well, Ford did bad, and Daimler Chrysler as a whole did well, but the Chrysler group itself did bad.
I think
in a nutshell, that's what happened. GM,
but when we say GM did well though, and we're still talking about what was it, $3.2
billion
loss for the second quarter, if I recall.
Right. I'd have to look it up specifically. I don't have that figure in front of me. But we had Rick Wagoner, you know, on the GM Fastlane blog saying,
right,
you know, this is the first step. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but we're pretty mm-hmm. proud that, you know, obviously the turnaround's working. I think, you know, on the back of a good quarter that shows definite improvement, I think a quarter is something to get excited about. It's not quite fair for an automaker to say, ooh, we had a good June and work turned around.
No, that's not representative of the year. There's no doubt about it. Yeah.
Right. A quarter you can get kind of excited about, especially this quarter. And this past quarter, I'm more interested in the quarter that's going on now that's going to cover the summer, with obviously not nearly the amount of incentives there were last year. Sales are obviously going to be down, and everybody's aware of that. But if somebody
right.
can pull out a decent earning in the quarter, that will say a lot.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Yeah, and the major thing is, well, what incentives are they going to do? They're not going to do the employee pricing this year. They've got to be pulling something else out though to make it through the summer, don't they?
Well, they do have incentives, but it seems like both Ford and GM are sticking with 0% financing. That's a big one for
right.
them this year. Cash back, just, you know, putting cash back on the hood, and then mm-hmm. these little kind of creative incentives like I'll, you know, pay your gas for a year or cap the price
right.
of gas or whatever. Which, you know, are pretty much just veiled ways of giving cash back. I'd rather have the cash myself.
But you bring up a really interesting point about the 0% APR and who is actually going to be coming into dealerships to buy vehicles. Mitsubishi had a huge problem with that a couple years back when they had their 0% financing and sold, you know, vehicles hand over fist, but they had so many people renege on their contracts. And there's a lot of people that think that that's a large reason, aside from a lot of other problems, why Mitsubishi's having a lot of problems now, because they had all these vehicles that they weren't able to get paid off in time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, incentives are always tricky. They're obviously just trying to clear their inventory. They're not necessarily, although I say that, and you know, many late 2006 or early 2007 models that are also have incentives on them, so they're just trying to move cars at all costs right now. But
no, the new GMT 900 SUVs, those are they've been trying to throw money on the hood for a long time.
Right,
those, so.
Right. Which it's funny. Those SUVs, I think, are really good, and I didn't grow up a GM fan. I've told people many times that I grew up in northeastern Ohio near Cleveland, which is obviously Ford territory.
No doubt.
And the GM full-size SUVs, I'm totally impressed with. And you told me before the show that you're seeing them everywhere. I'm seeing them a lot of places too. And it's funny that they came out and they're a good product in my eyes, just came out at a bad time. But I think GM is trying to do the best they can with them. And it's succeeding as much as they could be expected to.
Well, especially living in suburbia, that's where their profit center is for those vehicles. And
oh yeah,
until gas starts really getting up high, people are going to be very, very content with driving these large vehicles. That they enjoy the ride, and like you said, they pretty much nailed it. They realized that this new platform was going to be a huge moneymaker for them, and they needed to get everything right: interior, ride, engine, everything had to be perfect.
If they had any hope of breaking even with it, it had to be perfect.
Exactly.
And they had to do it now, because if they waited a year or two and gas prices got even worse, it'd be even
exactly.
a bigger mess. And then you take a look at Daimler Chrysler, though, and Ford and GM have been very measured with their incentives. They've been very I don't know why I can't think of it, but they've been safe with them. They haven't put out a lot. But Daimler Chrysler
right.
is, throwing the kitchen sink at you, they're the ones who went the employee pricing route again, which I think is a big signal that there's a problem if you're going to pull out.
No doubt, and judging by their earnings.
Yeah, knowing how much they were damaged, all three of them were damaged last year from employee pricing. I think GM and Ford weren't going to do it no matter what, and Daimler Chrysler Group particularly apparently had to, because their inventory was so big. And that bore out in the second quarter earnings for Daimler Chrysler. The company as a whole, like we said, did well, but the Chrysler Group pretty much erased almost all profit that the rest of the group made. Mercedes did well, and their financial services and their commercial truck, they all did well.
But unfortunately, this is that counterbalance that didn't quite work out very well for the whole group.
Right, this counterbalanced it and took out a lot of those earnings. And we've been hearing rumblings that, is Chrysler going to go back, and has it fallen on its face, and is this the part of the cycle again where they go near the brink of death and then come back miraculously as they do every 5 years?
Well, there was so much hope when the 300C came out. I mean, that was a huge seller, and there's talk of the redesigned Caravan and Voyager and all that. And we've finally seen spy shots of that, and they're just slab sided as they always have been. And I guess the gentleman that designed the 300C is actually on top for the Voyager project as well. And then we see the Sebring come out, and I think that's been kind of wholly ridiculed by the press and everybody else as just being not the greatest vehicle they could have came out with right now, unfortunately, especially for a market segment that's that saturated, that has that many good options. I mean, heated and cooled cup holders is a really, really neat feature, and having a huge hard drive in the dashboard is all fine and dandy. But as a lot of people have brought up, it looks like a horrible amalgamation of a lot of different vehicles kind of thrown together. And so if they're planning on that to be one of their saving graces for that market segment,
I hope
they got more on the drawing board.
I don't think it's going to be a saving grace, but I think one thing Chrysler knows how to do better than anyone else is polarize in the right way. Because you can polarize people with a design where half the people hate it and half the people love it.
Oh, absolutely.
You can do that in a bad way that fails, or you can do it in a good way.
The Imperial concept's a prime example of that, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm not going to count out the Sebring until the numbers start rolling in. I admit it doesn't look normal. it looks very odd, and it looks like they did take every styling cue that Chrysler has ever had in the past 20 years.
And GMs too. Yeah.
Right, and just threw it on there. But maybe the saving grace of that vehicle is it's going to be a great handler. You never know. You never know what might come through for it.
No, there's no doubt. But like I said, at this point, it's not looking good, but we will reserve judgment until we actually get one in the Autoblog garage.
Yeah, which hopefully, that'll probably be a while, but we'll get one eventually. So, again, this was the first half of the year, their second quarter reports. I don't think anything was too surprising. Ford's were Ford, I think Ford lost something like 120 some billion, which was painful. And
there's no doubt.
They're going back to the drawing board with the Way Forward plan, and are basically going to ramp up plant closings and layoffs and all of that, and probably push up some product debuts, which I don't know what's going on with Ford. I don't think that their lineup is necessarily worse than General Motors.
No, I tend to agree with that. How do you have any idea how their Bold Moves website, the FordBoldMoves.com, is doing? Is that the site? I believe.
Yeah. I think it's doing well. I mean, obviously, there's a big marketing push. You can see the ads on Autoblog. I wrote a couple pieces for it, and so did Sebastian from Autoblog Green,
cool.
Which was fun. And you know, it's an interesting site in that it is paid for by Ford's ad agency, but Ford doesn't have anything to do with it, and you're allowed to say whatever you want on it.
Yeah, well, that was the major thing. Is I think the article you wrote was actually had some kind of critical things, and I think one of the last ones that came out was somebody from an environmentalist organization just mm-hmm. railing into Ford's lack of green vehicles and average fuel economy standards and all that stuff.
Well, the fun part of the website is the webisodes, the documentary Ford
right.
Bold Moves, and yeah, they're hard on themselves, or the documentary episodes that come out every week. They're hard on Ford. I mean, they always end with kind of a silver lining of hope. But
yeah, no, it's we're making changes. Yeah, gotta. Yeah.
Right. But they are very critical of Ford, that you know what Ford has done or not done in the past. Okay, so let's move on before we get mired in all of this.
Please.
Analyst mumbo jumbo. And let's talk about something fun, which is the Tesla Roadster that was unveiled a week or so ago.
Absolutely.
And this is basically an all-electric vehicle. It's a small roadster, looks like a Lotus Elise. The reason is because it was designed by people from Lotus.
It will be manufactured there
by Lotus in England. It's built by a company, of course, called Tesla Motors, that was backed by a lot of famous people who invested in it. A guy from Google, a guy from a lot of other dot-coms. They kind of called this a Silicon Valley car.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was made by people who made their money in the dot-com era.
But really, can the CEO of Google really be classified as a celebrity? Or?
Well, in some circles,
in certain
yes,
groups,
yes.
I've got no doubt.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, if I were talking to the Engadget guys right now, yes, he would be a celebrity. And so the Roadster was unveiled, and I think the lead-up to it, everyone got really excited because of the claims of what this Roadster could do. 130
right,
mile per hour top speed, 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, range of 250 miles, which on batteries, is insane. I mean, you look at other electric vehicles that are out on the road and they're claiming 70 mile per hour top speed with a range of 80 miles, you know, and
right.
like, and that's just not real world. That's not practical enough to use.
No matter how many people you talk to, say, well, the average commuter's round trip is 8 miles and yada, yada, yada. I mean, there's really that's not going to work for mass appeal, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's not about what I actually do in a day. It's about what I could do or, you know, the capability. If I need to do that, I need to be able to. So we
What's
were
the
all
tech on the batteries, by the way.
What's the take on them?
What's the tech on it? I mean, what
like,
kind of
what
battery
is
it? Yeah.
Well, basically, they're lithium-ion batteries, and I think the real innovation was that instead of going the route where let's take, you know, 18 car batteries and string them together like a lot of
right.
EVs do, this is basically 4,000 lithium-ion laptop batteries, in a sense. I mean, that's reducing the complexity a bit. But,
right.
yeah. I think the angle that this car has over other electric vehicles is since these guys all came from the computer industry, they know that the best R&D on battery technology isn't happening in the automotive sector. It's happening in the laptop computer sector. Where
right. No
there's,
doubt.
Yeah, these people are extracting so much from batteries and are asking so much from them. So Tesla saw that and basically said, let's string together 4,000 batteries. And the neat thing is Autoblog Green had an interview with I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Elon Musk, who's the
yeah.
chairman of Tesla, and he was describing it, and we asked him, you know, what happens at 100,000 miles when these, you know, the lifespan of these batteries is gone? And he said there's 4,000 cells, so at 60 or 80,000, let's say some of the cells have already gone, you can replace them individually at a much, much greater cost than replacing the whole thing. Or, you know, when the time comes at 100 or 110,000 miles,
mm-hmm.
You can replace the whole thing. And since these are lithium-ion batteries, you know, it can go to a recycler and you can get some value back for it because they're not totally dead. They're just they're just down. So it's kind of modular in a sense. And we also asked him, you know, you say 250-mile range, but what happens if I do 4 0-to-60 blasts? Is it down to like 10 miles?
Right.
And he told us they were doing, when they were doing demonstrations at the show, for I think 4 or 5 hours, they had two cars just doing 0-to-60 blasts. And they didn't need
to recharge.
Yeah, they didn't have to recharge
it
at all. So it's funny because we all think we know what electric vehicles are like. And this electric vehicle is so outside of what we think an electric vehicle is capable of, it still sounds like hyperbole. It still sounds like it's too good to be true. So Sebastian got a ride in it, and it's funny, if you watch the video, he's recording it, you know, in the passenger seat, and the guy hits the gas, it takes off, and you hear him kind of hit the back of the seat and go, whoa. he did not expect what was coming.
0-to-60 in 4 seconds. That's gonna push your kidneys back into the right location.
Yeah. And it's funny. They have very long-term plans. I mean, they really want to be like, you know, the Tucker of the 21st century and build a car company. They have plans for a sedan next. And he talked about Model One is this the Tesla Roadster? And I think he called them models. Model 2, Model 3, and Model 4, and he said something by like the fourth revision, they'll have, you know, mass production, much more practical utility.
And they're also looking into a sedan as well, right?
Yeah, the sedan will be the Model 2,
okay.
And it probably won't. I think this is where the big variable is he rests a lot of this on where battery, laptop or computer battery technology will be in two or 3 years and 10 years and in 20 years. And he's betting a lot that it's going to get a lot better. And it may. I mean, I'm into laptops and computers too, and I have seen them improve a lot over the years. But then again, I also see laptops spontaneously exploding too. So I don't exactly know. I don't really know where it is or how far it can go. But
right. Well, especially as temperamental as the batteries are right now, you think about most manufacturers of whether it's cell phone batteries or whatever, and they're very, very specific about the amount of time you need to leave it on charge. Don't keep it plugged in for long periods of time unnecessarily. And I think that end of the tech, I mean, the electric motors are one thing, and the chassis looks gorgeous from the shots I've seen.
Yeah, it really is a good-looking vehicle.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about that. But I think that just the tech when it comes to the batteries, that seems to be the biggest concern.
Well,
and
we should be careful, though, because I've talked to people who know way more than any one person should know about batteries. And I think there are certain batteries that have, like, memory, and you're not supposed to, you know, charge them when they're halfway full or, you know, you have to wait till they do. But lithium ions are, I believe, they can be anything. You don't have to.
They're not quite as temperamental.
Yeah. You don't have to do all that conditioning and stuff like that. And again, the way Elon was describing it is that since it's modular, you know, when these batteries start to go, it's not like they're going to just stop working. It's going to be like a car, you know. A 10-year-old car or a 5-year-old car isn't going to accelerate as fast or go as far on a tank of gas as a brand new car. And it'll be just like that. You know, the batteries won't hold as much a charge, and you won't be able to go as fast, you know, 5 years down the road. But you take these out, you know, you can either, again, replace them one by one as they're going or all at once, and then and you're back up to speed. Everyone should go to Autoblog Green and take a look at the interview because he has some great examples of why getting your power from the grid, for instance, is less harmful, has less of an impact on the environment, and is cheaper. I mean, this guy obviously did all his homework, and any kind of criticism you throw at him, he's ready for it and can rebut it in 2 seconds. I mean,
he's got Perry to go with it.
Yeah. He's, you know, part salesman, part CEO, so he obviously knows what he's doing. And I don't know. I wish I could have been Sebastian and taken a ride on that. But
I guess that's the obvious question: is when are we going to start seeing this? I mean, have they only produced what, two vehicles so far, or how many have they produced so far? Do we have any idea?
Well, that first day, they opened up the orders for the first 100, which are called the Signature Series, and he said there were only a few left. So He said by the Oscars, I think you're going to see tons of them at the Oscars. Of course, all the, you know, famous people who are into driving hybrids and stuff. You know, what I think is just funny is that, man, electric vehicles were thought to be so dead. It was just thought to be, okay, they're a dead end. The best we can do with batteries is hybrids until we have hydrogen. If he gets this going, and really there is a breakthrough in either the types of batteries he's using or how he's using them, I mean, electric vehicles could have a whole new resurgence. But it's just
no, there's no doubt this could be a huge revolutionary thing. I'm not sure if the Tucker example was the best, but
well, I think he has a Tucker mentality. I mean, he really thinks that he can start a brand new car company and, you know, in 15, 20 years be considered among, you know, a legitimate player in the industry with all electric vehicles, which, you know,
I think it'd be easier to kind of look at it from maybe like a supercar startup as far as, you know, production capacity and how long it's going to take to get the cars on the road, because that's more or less what he's doing. He's kind of starting from scratch, you know, at least with most supercar startups, you can source the engine from BMW or Mercedes or
And that's what he's doing,
wherever.
Yeah. He's sourcing everything from suppliers and is leaning heavily on Lotus, but no, I mean, again, listen to him talk and he'll tell you 10, 15 years down the road, it's going to be mass production time with, you know, mainstream cars. So we'll have to wait and see, but hopefully the Tesla will be in the spotlight again pretty soon, because I want to get people's reactions, and I doubt we're going to get one in the Autoblog Dream Garage, but somebody's going
to
get one.
I will pray every night just to make sure it happens. By the way, what's he doing about the crash testing and that kind of thing? Because I'd hate to see two of these things go into a wall.
Well, I believe he has to crash test them. He's not listing them as like a kit car. I don't think he's getting any way around it.
Right.
You know, and since it's all, you know what, they may have different rules for all electric vehicles. I don't know. We should look into that. But, yeah, he's not selling it as like a, you know, parted out kit car, like the Noble or anything like that.
Right.
So I think he's got to deal with it, which, yeah,
so
sucks for him. Okay, let's move on
Soldier
to the next
on.
Topic. Soldier on. Keep going. Last thing we're going to talk about is the Mazda Speed 3. Which,
I want one.
Yeah, I want one too. This may have risen to the top of my gotta have it list. Basically, the price for the Mazda Speed 3 is going to start at $22,800, and that's for the four-door. I called it a hatch wagon and got yelled at in the comments. I think that's what it is. It's what do you call it?
I mean, four-door classifications, five-door. I honestly will always call them wagons, no matter what, and I'll take the flack for it. Honestly, it's a wagon.
It's sport wagon, maybe, to make it sound better.
Yeah, that's yeah.
But obviously, the gem of the car is the 250 horsepower engine, turbo four. Got 18-inch wheels, four-wheel disc brakes, ABS.
Naturally.
There are two models, the Sport and the Grand Touring.
Grand Touring, right.
And the Grand Touring starts at 24-something, 24,000?
24,515, I think.
And that obviously is pretty much decked out and loaded, probably with all the stuff that I wouldn't want. I'm actually
looking at the list right now, automatic on-off headlights, rain-sensing wipers.
Yeah, don't care.
Xenon, yeah, exactly. LED rear combination taillights, I think I'll pass
don't
on
care,
that.
Don't care.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that's an option on the Grand Touring is the DVD navigation, which I like DVD navigation, but I hate that.
I've yet to experience it, so that's one of those things that I got to play with it with the new Civic Si recently, and I really, really dug on it a lot there. And that, you know, kind of a nice segue. That's definitely obviously one of the competitors. You can throw this right into that group with the GTI, the Civic Si, and now the Mazda Speed 3. Although I'm not sure what your opinion is, but looking at the GTI and the Civic, my only concern with the Mazda Speed 3 is I'm not sure. You probably, of course, there's the sedan version of the Mazda 3, and I would sooner go for the sedan version than I would for the sport wagon.
Really?
I just like the lines on that more. I think it looks a little bit more crisp. I mean, I've owned wagons before, and I really, really like the functionality of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I know I'm in the minority, but I'd love to see them do it with just the normal four-door version.
I disagree, and I'll tell you why. One, I do like the way the wagon, the five-door, the whatever looks.
Oh, it's not an ugly vehicle, don't get me wrong.
I think the four-door to me looks a little squished. It looks a little like the proportions are from a large sedan that's just been squished together from both ends. But regardless
okay.
of that, obviously the utility I like more.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, I don't know where I picked this up, but wagons tend to have a lot better weight distribution in front-wheel drive cars. And they do feel better balanced because of that extra weight on the back. And actually, I do remember where I got it from. In long ago, an issue of Car and Driver, the guys built a wagon version of the Ford Taurus SHO, which is one of my favorite cars of all time. And it was by the time the second gen Taurus, and it was an automatic. So it was an automatic Taurus show wagon, and it actually I forget what circuit they were at, but it lapped the circuit faster than the sedan. And
really?
The driver they had said it handles sublime because the weight distribution's now pretty much dead on 50-50. And he's like, it's totally neutral. Whereas the sedan would just plow into corners and understeer. So not that I, you know, not
from a
that
dynamic
I'm,
point of view, no, that's a definitely a valid argument.
Yeah, not that I, you know, in my daily driving or whatever, you know, feel the difference of, you know, an extra 100 pounds on the back. But that is the thing,
right.
too.
Well,
you have to deal with the
extra weight.
Most people
aren't driving at 8/10 on their way to work, so.
Right. And I think the real question, though, is in this segment where you it goes everywhere from the Honda Civic Si with a little less than 200 horsepower.
Right,
and it's,
absolutely no torque.
Right, and it's going to go up to the Dodge Caliber SRT4, which is going to have 300 horsepower in a front-wheel drive car. And the question is, at what point have you gone too far for front-wheel drive? And I think
the Caliber becomes a new 200. Yeah.
Exactly. 300 is a new 200. I think the Caliber went for shock value, but it might be so undrivable that it's not going to be enjoyable.
No, there's torque steer, tram lining, all that stuff's going to be a huge issue. And honestly, as much as I trust Mazda engineers and their driving dynamic, that's my biggest concern. You're putting 250 horsepower down to the front wheels. That can be a possibly really, really disastrous combination for handling and acceleration. So.
Yeah, and I wonder if the GTI's 200 horsepower 2-liter might be the perfect one, or if somebody's out there who's going to come out with like a 220. I think 220, 225 through the front wheels is a good combination in a light car.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, definitely.
The Honda Civic Si, I'm not a huge fan of having to ring the engine to like 9,000 RPM to have any fun. I know some people like that a lot. I'm more of the effortless power kind of guy, so I like torquey four cylinders, although there aren't as many out there.
No, one of the vehicles that I really, really enjoyed when I had it, I had a 98 Type R, and yeah, that was the thing, is there was absolutely no torque. It was a beautifully handling vehicle, especially with the LSD and all that, but until you got up, when VTEC kicked in at about 6,200 RPM, 6,400 RPM, it was just, but some people like that. It's just the fact that, you know, if they're going to putt around town, they can just kind of do that leisurely, still get just killer gas mileage. That was the one thing that always cracked me up about that vehicle, and it was making 195 horsepower, but I don't remember what the torque was, 130.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that's the same problem with the SI. But of course, once again, it's a naturally aspirated engine. It's just, I mean, once you get it up past that VTEC point and it gets all the way to 8,000 RPM, that's some people like that. Like you said, some people don't. I'm going to have to tend to agree with you I like the low end torque. I like something that's going to put me around town, but I'm going to have fun doing it rather than having to get up.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of four cylinders. I tend to like the European four cylinders that are pretty gutsy down low. Even if they don't have as high a top end, but I think the Mazda Speed 3. What do you think of 22.8 though? Is that low or is that high?
Oh, I think that's literally the perfect spot to be right in there. There's
yeah,
no doubt
I think
about
so
that
too.
Because you figure the Civic Si starts at 19.9. If you can find it, all the dealers have a markup about $1,500 to $2,000 from what I've seen. You can max out the SI at about, 24.5, right around there. You can max out the GTI at about 25 or 26, and this one's maxed out at 24.5.
Where does it land in terms of the Impreza WRX?
That's a good question.
Probably similar.
Yeah, well, you figure the WRX, I think I'm not sure if the pricing on the wagon is still less than the sedan, but it was like a $500 difference. The wagon was a little bit cheaper. But, you know, lacking the all-wheel drive, that's obviously the biggest thing. And once again, when you've got with like the WRX, you've got 230, 240 horsepower going to all four wheels. Granted, there's a lot of parasitic loss through the driveline and all that, but it's easily handled, and you can tell the vehicle once more. I mean, you know, go to any, you know, major car show, you're going to see a dozen and a half WRXs that are tuned to the bejesus. And like I said, I'm really, really concerned once again when it comes down to how much power we can really get out of these front wheels without having problems.
We'll see. I think it's a hot product, and speaking of all of the second quarter returns, Mazda came back and had a great quarter. So I think they have just outstanding product in the pipeline.
They're making good cars. There's no doubt about that. They're making some of the best vehicles right now. Even their MPV is still, you know, what's the Mazda 5? I'm seeing more of those around town now.
Yeah, I'm starting to see more of those. They didn't really market it very well at the beginning.
No, not at all. But you're starting to see them because it's people that, you know, want something small but still want the ability of a minivan and not actually have a quote-unquote minivan. So, no, they're just kicking butt, taking names. And
yeah,
this is yet another long one.
The CX-7 coming down the pipeline, I've just started to see the commercials for those, and that looks
And I've actually seen two out here already.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, yeah.
That looks like the most fun SUV since the Murano. I mean, it just looks like I mean, it's funny. I don't think many people believe that the Zoom Zoom marketing treatment is effective anymore. But I really get that feeling with Mazda that they do try to infuse performance and fun into cars and try not to be boring at all costs.
No, they've done a really, really good job with that.
Yeah.
I wish it would spread throughout the Ford product line too, but that's their niche, and they've been doing really, really well with it so far.
If Ford could take the essence of Mazda and Volvo and mash them together and have that be Ford, everything would be fine. Everything would be all right.
You're biased, though, so.
Yeah, that's right. I'm from Northeast Ohio, so they make all the engines in my backyard, so. Okay, well, that's all we had to talk about for this week, and I'm sure plenty of things will happen between now and the next time we have a podcast to talk about. So thank you for joining us for the first time, Damon. It was nice to have you. And
my pleasure. Enjoyed it thoroughly.
And before we leave, of course, we have to give Volvo, our sponsor, a chance to say a few more words.
The Volvo XC90 has won over 50 international automotive awards, including the 2005 Best Pick from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety and Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com Top 10 Award for Best Resale Value. Visit www.volvocars.us for more information.
Okay, and before we leave everyone today, I just want to remind you all to visit autoblog.com. Every day we have posts going up. All day long. So whenever something happens in the automotive world, we try to grab it and get it up as soon as possible so you can always find what's going on. Also visit Autoblog Green, which is our sister site that we launched recently. They're doing very well, and their coverage of the Tesla Roadster, I think, is a testament.
Tremendous. That was really, really good.
Yeah, we definitely were fortunate and got some good guys with Sebastian and Bruno and Joel over there who are just working their butts off. And turning that into a really good site. And, of course, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you guys again in a little while.
Have a good week.